here we are, we're sitting in New York City today. If we went outside and looked up the street, I guarantee you we'd see double parked delivery trucks, right? And that's very annoying as a, you drive, I drive, in this, I have a car. That's very annoying. I will never be annoyed again. I'd never spend a day with a truck driver. I am just so in awe of what these people do. There's nowhere to park a truck in a major city. There's no zones for it. It's an inhospitable situation. So the whole day is an adventure.
Behind every amazing flavor is an amazing human who has perfected their craft. Welcome to Flavors Unknown, a series of inspirational conversations with renowned culinary leaders. Discover how their cultural identity shapes their creative process. With your host, Emmanuel.
Welcome to another episode of the Flavors Unknown podcast, where we embark on a culinary adventure with the minds shaping our dining experiences. I am your host, Emmanuel LaRoche. I have been in the food industry for more than 20 years, both in Europe and in the US. And every other week, I have genuine conversations with acclaimed chefs, pastry chefs, and mixologists from around the country. And today, I am thrilled to have Andrew Friedman with us, the acclaimed author of the new book, The Dish, and the voice behind the insightful Andrew Talks to Chefs podcast. Join us as we delve into the inspiration behind The Dish, exploring the intricate journey of a single plate from conception to consumption, and uncover the collaborative spirits of the culinary world. We also peel back the layers of Andrew's podcast, discovering what drives him to spotlight the genesis behind our favorite meals. We'll also peel back the layers of Andrew's podcast, discovering what drives him to spotlight the genesis behind our favorite meals.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Hi, Emmanuel. How are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Welcome to Flavors Unknown. I'm excited to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been a long time coming, and I'm very honored to be here.
Not too long ago, I was on your podcast, you know, Andrew Talks to Chef, covering my first book, you know, that I published, in fact, a year ago. So it's been the anniversary in November. And now I have you on my podcast talking about your new book, The Dish. I really love, you know, reading that book. There's a lot of details, but before we get into it, I just want to understand what inspired you to you know, to write this book.
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. The book, you know, I think people don't believe me because I get asked about it a lot. But, you know, I mentioned in the foreword to the book that I was inspired by a dream. I dreamt the idea for the book. I woke up one day and I just had the idea. I had the idea. I had the title. I kind of knew how it was going to start and how it was going to end, although how it was going to start changed, but it ends exactly the way it was going to end when I pitched it to the publisher. So that's where the idea came from. Subconsciously, I think it came from, this is kind of a new trend in the stuff I'm doing because it's true of the next thing I'm going to write also. I think I'm trying to fill in selfishly, use my books and my research to get paid to fill in gaps in my own knowledge, you know? So I've spent a lot of time observing in kitchens. I've co-authored a lot of books, more than 24 with chefs. So I've spent a lot of time interviewing them. But I couldn't have told you all the people that come together, you know, in one plate, you know, if you really reverse engineer it and go back out to the farms and the delivery trucks and the meat processing plants. I didn't know all that. And I also, because the book takes place during a service, you get sort of a slow motion tracking of how we go from a guest ordering from at the table to the chit going into the kitchen and then to the finished plate coming to the table. We, you know, we see everything that happens in between those events in super slow motion throughout the book. And I couldn't have told you exactly how all of that happened. So I think subconsciously, that was my, it was selfish because I wanted to,
learning curve, I wanted to
deepen my knowledge because I've never worked in a restaurant for all the writing. Well, I take it back. I was a busboy once at a Mexican restaurant in Miami, Florida in the 1980s, but I don't even count that. But you know, I really had no idea how all this stuff worked at a micro level.
And so what made you choose that specific restaurant and that specific dish for the story?
The restaurant was, it was a gut instinct.
Because you know a lot of chefs and you could have selected, you know, a lot of restaurants around the country or even in New York where you are, you know, you're based at.
I could have. In fact, I had never met the Johnny Clark and Beverly Kim who own the restaurant in the book. I had never met them. And so this is very unusual. I sold the book just based on the concept during the first 6 or 7 months of COVID, November of 2020, in a phone call. Unexpected. It was an idea I'd been sitting on. I was waiting for the pandemic to end. And unexpectedly, I found myself with an opportunity to pitch somebody. And they bought the concept without the restaurant selected, which is very unusual. Normally, I would have had to have it in the proposal, but we were in the middle of a plague. So nothing was normal. And I was basically conducting by telephone a casting search from my home office. And I was getting leads from friends and I was talking to chefs in different places around the country. There were certain things I wanted. You know, I wanted an independent restaurant. I wanted a place that got most, if not all, of their proteins and produce from area farms, independent family-owned farms. I really didn't have a huge interest in going to like huge, you know, processing plants and corporate agriculture situation. I had no interest in that. So and I also wanted to be in kind of an emerging food city, you know, Austin, Texas, or Oakland, California, or Philadelphia. Brooklyn's kind of arrived, but it still feels like it's emerging. I never would have wanted to be in Chicago or Manhattan.
No, yeah.
Yeah. So the restaurant is in Chicago. It's actually the restaurant as it existed, doesn't exist anymore, I'm sorry to say, but it was Wherewithal Restaurant in Chicago. And I, in the midst of my search, interviewed one of the two chef owners, Beverly Kim, who people may have seen on Top Chef season 9. That was a while ago. But we just had this amazing interview. And as you know, I do all my interviewing in person. But because of COVID, I was doing remote interviews and I was not using the video option. So it was like a phone call, you know, and, you know, we couldn't see each other. And she was such an open book. And she and Johnny have an amazing reputation together and independently. And I just thought, wow, these are kind of the people I've been looking for. So as soon as I stopped recording, I said, this is going to come out of nowhere.
You pitched the idea.
Do you think you and your husband and your team would like to be the center of a book? And that began a series of Zoom phone calls and communication with the staff and getting everybody on board.
Wow.
But as far as picking the dish, that restaurant changed its menu every week. So
it's a tasting menu too, correct?
What's that?
Is it a tasting menu?
It's a tasting menu only. Yeah. And because they changed it every week, I did not know what the dish would be until... So they were open from Tuesday to Saturday. I arrived on a Sunday. Monday morning, I met Johnny and Beverly at an Intelligentsia coffee in Chicago. And that was the first time we had met. And Johnny showed me a little notebook with a little very simple sketch because it is a very simple dish. And he said, well, this is what I'm thinking. And it was strip loin with, you know, half of a partially dehydrated tomato and red wine reduction and sorrel, right? And that was it. And until that moment, until the dish officially went on the menu the next day, Tuesday, I didn't know who the farms were. So I...
Because that was part of your, you know, desire as well, is to have a select pick a dish that had enough elements to yes. cover all the, like, the farmers and, you know, like, people raising, you know, proteins and, you know, and so on, to be as large as possible, correct?
Yes, but this ended up being... So when they told me the dish, to be honest, I was a little worried, because I was like, in my mind, I was like, that's it, you know? But it actually ended up being perfect, because there were five key purveyors, and that's enough, you know? From produce farm to produce farm,
yeah,
it's not that different, the practices, at least at this level, you know, family-owned farms that try to do things more or less in a sustainable way, some of them organically. You know, one meat purveyor, that was plenty. And then the surprise, which was kind of a gift, I think, from Johnny and Taylor, the chef at the restaurant, is there was this red wine reduction made with a wine from Michigan. So I got to include a tour of a vineyard
yeah.
in the book, which I was not expecting, okay. right? And so it ended up being ideal. It ended up being, and also the dish looks very simple and it sounds very simple, but you know, it was easily enough to fill 200 and whatever pages. And to, I, you know, I could have easily gone another 200. You know, I don't write about the dry goods. You know, I don't go to the salt marshes where, you know, the sea salt comes from. I don't go to where the olive oil is produced. I guess I could have, or I could have maybe, given the budget I had, I could have done that over the phone. But you know, I didn't do that. I didn't think that would be as interesting. And I also thought the book would start to feel a little long. You know, the book, especially compared to my last one, it's, you know, it's lightweight, it's brisk. And I really like, I like that. I like that. I think it, the length to me feels really good.
You're talking the previous book, it's like Chef, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that book was, that's a door stopper. Yeah.
Maybe it's going to be a provocative question, but I was surprised with the choice of the restaurant. Nothing against that restaurant at all, but knowing your network, I was expecting maybe that you would have chosen like a more, let's say, known restaurants, and as well maybe more acclaimed chefs, you know, on for the book. So,
well, I don't know. Actually, you know, I don't think the people I interviewed, I can't say who they were.
Sure, of course.
But you know, I had five finalists.
Sure.
None of them, some of them are less well-known than Beverly and Johnny. I mean, Beverly and Johnny have a Beard Award.
Mm-hmm.
Their other restaurant, Parachute, is, I think it still is, but it was a Michelin-starred mm-hmm. restaurant.
Sure.
It's been around for a decade. So I was okay with that. I, you know, a lot of, I don't know. I kind of
And your publisher were not as well?
I got no pressure.
No pressure at all?
No, my publisher was great.
Okay.
I mean, we consulted, we spoke, but, you know, it was my choice. And
good.
No, I had zero. That never came up, to yeah, be yeah. honest. You know, yes, I am friends with a lot of people who are very well known. You know, a lot of those people aren't day-to-day running. I don't think I'm saying anything. I mean, I'm not.
No, no, I know
anybody,
what you mean. They're not behind. They're not behind the stove.
They're not developing yeah. the menu.
Sure,
you
sure.
You know, they're not. Yeah. They're not coming.
They are
up
more with, like, you know, manager and or
they're
CEOs
restaurateurs.
Of
they
there.
Become yeah. restaurateurs. Yeah. So honestly, and again, I really wanted. I mean, Beverly and Johnny, I think, are around 40, but you know, for chef owner, that's still pretty. You know, that's on the younger side. I was really about. I really wanted young. You know, I wanted a young food city. I wanted relatively young protagonists. I mean, I was always going to profile the cook, so I would have had some of that anyway. But I really wanted, you know, the generation that's kind of coming to its own right now.
Okay.
You know, I'm a little bit obsessed with age, and I'm in my 50s now, and I've seen other writers age out. You know, they just stop keeping up with what's new. Mm-hmm. They stop meeting young cooks and chefs. They stop going to new restaurants. They're very resistant to changes in styles of dining and the lessening of the formality of dining. And I'm very much, very deliberately and naturally, I try to go against that. You know, I think it's really important. And no, I never thought about doing this with, I hate the term, but it's just the easiest one, but like a quote unquote celebrity chef. I never even considered it. Okay. I don't think it's funny. That wasn't,
no, but it's
like, it wasn't a conscious decision not to do that, but it's a great question. No one's asked me that before, but now that I think about it, I didn't approach anybody at that level.
And it's interesting as well to hear that your publisher didn't really put pressure on this, because knowing the book market at the moment, knowing the fact that, you know, in order to make sure there's a certain level of sales and so on, so they would have maybe considered to have, you know, a restaurant or like a chef, which is more mainstream, or, you know, in like in the public image, I would say. So that's really interesting to say that they gave you carte blanche, you know, on...
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, every conversation we had, you know, the publisher is Mariner Books, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. And Peter Hubbard, who's the publisher there, was also my editor. It's a small house. And, you know, all those conversations would end with Peter saying, but, you know, Andrew, ultimately it's your book, it's your decision,
which that's great.
Yeah. As you know, having done a book, that's what you want to hear, because I just think I really needed people who aren't, you know, safeguarding an image, you know, who weren't going to have their publicist sitting with us at every interview, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff that comes with fame. I hate that stuff. I hate it in general. And I really didn't want it to invade the book process.
You know, you have been in this industry for a long time, you wrote about it, you know, for a long time. So I'm curious to see if there was anything that was either surprising or enlightening, something that you discovered that you were not really being aware of when you work on that book and the journey of the dish.
Well, the biggest thing for me was, and it's my favorite thing in the book, and a lot of people who I've heard from, it's their favorite thing in the book. You know, I spent a day with a truck driver, mm-hmm. and you know, I've spent a ton of time in restaurants, as I said. I have visited, because I've been doing this for about 25 years, I have visited a lot of farms, you know. Sometimes I've stayed overnight, you know, small family farms and places like the Chef's Garden, which, I mean, technically that is a family farm, but it's a big operation. You know, I've been around to a lot of these places, but I'd never spent a day with a truck driver. And, you know, I am just so in awe of what these people do. And I never had an appreciation for it before. But if you think about it, it's completely obvious, right? Because here we are, we're sitting in New York City today. If we went outside and looked up the street, I guarantee you we'd see double parked mm-hmm. delivery trucks, mm-hmm. right? And that's very annoying I have a car. That's very annoying. I will never be annoyed again. There's nowhere to park a truck in a major city. There's no zones for it. It's an inhospitable situation. So the whole day is an adventure. You know, as this guy I met, by the way, we met at 2:30 in the morning. He was already there and getting his, you know, his cargo together. And we went out around 3:30 and I was with him till about 10:30 and, you know, his problem-solving skills and his knowledge of the city and his nimbleness. I don't mean physical nimbleness. I mean, like, his nimbleness for navigating tough situations. You know, like, what happens if nobody's answering the buzzer? You know, you got to get on to the next delivery. What do you do? All this kind of stuff. That was, I expected nothing of it. I just was kind of like, I should probably go out on a delivery run. I kind of felt like it was just going to be driving around and dropping stuff off. And I was staying with friends of mine in Chicago at the time, one of whom is also a journalist in this same area. And I came back, you know, I mean, I was exhausted, but I came back and I said, I think I just experienced what's going to be the most entertaining part of the book, because it was like an odyssey. I mean, it was such an education for me. You know, beyond that, in terms of surprises, I was surprised how untraumatized I was by visiting the kill floor of a meat facility. I mean, I watched I watched a lamb go from a living creature.
I'm sure you had a lot of questions as well.
I watched a lamb go from a living, breathing, standing on its own four legs creature to a disemboweled, flayed
carcass. I've seen that carcass, myself.
So, you know, yeah. And it doesn't smell good, but I was, to my mind, surprisingly unfazed. I mean, I'd never even seen a video of it. I mean, I know what gets done, but so there was that. And then, you know, the similarities in personality types when I met this many of them in such close temporal proximity, because, you know, I spent a week at the restaurant and I observed and I interviewed all the people I needed to interview there. And then I came back to New York for 2 weeks. And then I went back to the Midwest and rented a car and I interviewed all the farmers in that week, right? And there's a lot of similarities in backstory and in kind of just mental makeup between chefs and farmers. You know, there's a lot of people I interviewed who have gravitated toward farming or winemaking who, you know, they're a little bit nonconformist. They're not office types. You know, they're not people who would take a normal job. They kind of like the unusual hours. You know, there's one farmer in particular, my friend now, John Templin from Butternut Sustainable Farms, who, you know, who loves to cook. So there's that. I mean, it is, those similarities were a surprise to me. And then the one other thing I would say is I have been very aware. I started to be around this business in the 90s when I was a publicist. And I mean, that was, you know, right in the midst still of this like rock and roll chef, party chef, you know, going out and getting hammered every night after work. I mean, that was normal. And that still is a feature of the industry, but it's by no means a given, you know? And I comment on it briefly in the book when everybody comes in from their weekends and everybody looks fresh as a daisy. You know, nobody's hungover. Nobody looks like they've been partying for 2 days straight. Everybody looks rested. You know, they all have water bottles. And that's such a change to see an entire team, you know, the whole staff fits that description. And I, you know, that for me really was like, wow, this is
a big change in,
this has really become a different, this has really become a different world. And again, that other stuff does go on, but, and if I'm honest, it was more fun to write about. I mean, it just was, you know, I mean, I don't know. I feel like I met some people in this book who I probably...
You could not have written like Chef's Drug and Rock and Roll now.
No, about this era, no. No. And I mean, I'm happier. It's better for all the people involved, definitely. But it's not as, you know...
For the storytelling.
Yeah, it doesn't make for as good... I mean, no offense to the characters in the book. I mean, I'm fond of everybody. And as a point of differentiation from the past... But that is an element, I think, of the industry. You know, we're all of the people who've been writing about it, you know, are going around apologizing for it. You know, the late Anthony Bourdain expressed some regret before, you know, in the years before he died about glamorizing, you know, that part of the life. But it was entertaining. But that, seeing it en masse, you know, seeing it across so many people in a concentrated amount of time, it really did strike me that this is a whole new ballgame now.
Yeah. I mean, another element as well that I felt, you know, evolved in the recent years, and that's a topic, at least the topic you talk about in the book, and I've seen this evolution, and I'm curious to see if you have seen it as well. You're talking about, you know, like collaboration, being like, you know, collaboration of the team within the restaurants, but as well the ecosystem with, you know, like the farmers and the purveyors and so on. And I have to say, with a lot of chefs that you have interviewed or I interview, you know, for the podcast, you could see as well that there's collaboration that goes now beyond like the industry. They are sometimes collaborating with artists and, you know, and so on. So have you seen that collaboration, I would say, approach change a lot in the past? Like the mindset of it, like, or the philosophical approach of collaboration change into like in the past 10 years or 20 years?
Yeah, I think that I think that how a certain subset of chefs think about what they do is always in flux, you know? And I think it's at a point now, and I think especially during the pandemic, coming out of the pandemic, I think anytime an entire population goes through a trauma like that, a lot of rules kind of fall by the wayside. And I just feel like a lot of chefs don't feel the need to compartmentalize food and a restaurant experience the way most of them used to, right? So I think—
What do you mean by that?
Well, that it's not, you don't just come in and order dinner or get the tasting menu, that there can be other elements to a meal, that there can be other parts of the experience, and that there can be other chefs involved in a dinner. I mean, this whole thing we see now with these collaboration dinners, mm-hmm. right? Like even that, I mean, maybe you would see a bunch of chefs each do a course, you know, for a charity or something. But these things that happen now where chefs come from Europe to New York or vice versa, and they spend a couple of days together and they collaborate on actual dishes and on the whole sweep of the menu. I mean, that's a pretty new thing.
Yeah.
That was not.
That's exciting.
But it's new.
Yeah, it is new. Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Like, again, maybe somebody would welcome someone and like let them take over their restaurant for a night. But this idea that they're going to come together and create dishes that, mm-hmm. you know, are unique just by what time of year it is and what's available and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's relatively new and it's become very normal, you know, but then you also see things like, you know, Alice Waters and David Tanis now have this restaurant in Los Angeles that's in a, you know, it's in an art museum. I haven't been able to visit it yet, but I want to, but I know that that's, you know, the fact that they're there influences the kind of thing they do. It didn't last, but, you know, Corey Lee, who used to be at the French Laundry, who has the restaurant Bennu in San Francisco, he for a time at a museum had a restaurant called In Situ, which, you know, he brought back, they brought back dishes from restaurants that don't exist anymore. And that was the menu, right? So it was almost like a museum menu, right? That's amazing. That didn't exist. Again, using a restaurant to give people a taste of what they can't get anymore, you know, a taste of the food that informed the food that we eat now. And then, as you said, everything in between, whether it's, you know, whether it's an artist. Yeah, I went to a benefit. They were trying to raise money. They still are, I think, to make a documentary about the life of Jean-Louis Paladin, who I don't know if everyone knows that name anymore, but Jean-Louis was a major, major chef in the late 70s and through the 80s, mostly in Washington, D.C., inspired a whole lot of people. And they're trying to raise money to make a documentary, and a bunch of chefs did a collaborative dinner. It was all chefs who had worked for him back in the day. But the menu for that night, the menu was incorporated into an original piece of artwork painted by Jacques Pepin.
Oh, wow.
Who was there that night, right? But even something like that, you know? I mean, these are things. I mean, you could look at the history of Chez Panisse, and there were elements of that kind of thing, but, you know, few and far between. So I do think that, I think the lines have been blurred, you know, as far as what, you know, what constitutes a dining experience.
Yeah.
And that, and also, you know, and this is a very long conversation that we can't have right now, but, you know, what is a chef? You know, I think chefs now regard themselves as, not every chef, but a subset of chefs, as people who belong in a room with artists, you know, who belong in a room with musicians, who belong in a room with architects. You know, they have that level of self-respect now. And frankly, you know, ego probably. But also those other people who function in those other disciplines agree with them, you know, and they see it as
legit. I think this is, you know, from all the discussion I had with chefs, is the step that has not been yet completely been taken is, for a lot of them, they still consider themselves are artisan and not as an artist. And there's a lot of discussion, and a lot of the topics, you know, of the podcast that I have and conversation with those are around the creative aspect and the creative process and so on. And they are always very reluctant or shy or, you know, on really going deep into, you know, that approach and so on. And when I ask them about if they consider themselves as artists, most of them challenge me back and say, no, we are not artists. So I really appreciate what you just mentioned, because I consider a lot of those chefs for me as artists, the way they plate, the way they approach, you know, the creation of a dish or even a tasting menu as a whole, you know, that really connects with the same way an artist, you know, is going to create a song or is going to create a painting or and so on. But it's still like very, I would say, not easy to have that conversation with most of the chefs.
Well, I think, and tell me if I'm spending too long on this topic, but, you know, I, early on in my own show, I had that conversation with a lot of people and a lot of chefs, and I was shocked at how many of them, almost, I don't know if I can even think of anyone who said it was an art, you mm-hmm. know, and the most surprising one to me was Massimo Bottura.
Yeah.
You know, who, I mean, if you look at what he does, it's so conceptual, mm-hmm. you know, like I used to always say that, I mean, I haven't been to the restaurant, but I've seen all the pictures, you know, he strikes me as a little bit of like a Dadaist, you know, like, and he immediately, when I asked him, said, I don't think so. It's not an art. And what he said was, because the food has to function as food, right? And he made the comparison, because he's Italian, to a sports car. And he said, you know, if you have a, let's say you have a Ferrari, right? First, it has to be able to run, right? And it has to run fast. Then you can worry about how it looks, right? And he compared that to cooking. I just had a very interesting conversation with a chef from Charlotte, North Carolina, named Sam Hart, who added another category, because food, to get it to behave the way you want it to be at the right temperature, all that stuff. They said to me that science.
Yeah.
They're also scientists.
Sure, of course.
Right? Now, I never thought of that.
Of course, yeah.
But that's a fascinating.
Sure.
I think that's a fascinating yeah. thing. And then I added to the conversation, there is this other thing about food that we never talk about. I just wrapped up my first semester teaching at the Culinary Institute, and it was a course on chef and restaurant history. And I hadn't really had this thought until I was filling in some blanks for myself, to be honest, because I went all the way back to the beginning of not just restaurants, but of people dining communally, right?
Okay.
And we take that as such a normal thing now. But there, you know, there was a time when you would only eat with that you're like your family, you know, whoever you dwelled with, right? And food is one of the very few, if not the only, animal. We don't like to think of ourselves as animals, but we are. And, you know, all these things, most of which we don't talk about in polite society, you know, like going to the bathroom or, you know, sex or, you know, dying. That's okay to talk about, but we don't talk about the moment, right? That all happens privately. Those are all things you do behind a closed door with intimate members of your, you know, of your life, right? Eating has been transformed into this. It's an indulgence. It's a pleasure. It can be visually gratifying, but at its essence, you're fulfilling an animal need, right? And yet we've turned it into this thing. And
true.
I don't think we think about that enough. It's such a unique part of life that we've made it that, you know, because we could have everything we have. We're sitting in this, you and I are interviewing, we're in a borrowed space today, a beautiful office building, and we have the elevators and all this great technology. We're in the middle of New York City. You could have all of this and we could still just be eating fruits and vegetables, you know, and cooking over, you know, just throwing an animal in an oven, I guess now, or over fire. It's not really integral to what we've done technologically, scientifically, but I think it speaks to kind of how we like to regard ourselves, you know, because it separates us, right, in a dramatic way now from, you know, from animals.
For other species.
Yeah. Yes. Sure. Anyway, not to get too philosophical, but I do think that is a fascinating thing that we're so, it's so ingrained after centuries that we don't even think about that. But, and this does bring up, you know, and I'm not just being politically correct, but it really does bring up this kind of, you know, Dickensian dichotomy. You know, I just came here on the subway and three people, you know, needed money or food. You know, they're not thinking about, you know, whether or not a meal spoke to them. You know, anyway, that's a long answer.
So I want to go back into a part of the book that I really enjoyed, which is connected to, let's say, the artist aspect and this idea of creativity as well, which is for me, the menu meeting chapter and the brainstorming menu session between Johnny, the owner, and Tyler, who is the chef, you know, there. So I'm curious because I'm sure like in your previous experiences that you had, you maybe attended before any other menu creation sessions. And I just wanted to know if what you observed there was different from what you have seen before. How was it unique? And especially because it was a tasting menu, so which is different from most restaurants that do not have a tasting menu. So I'm just curious to how did you, I would say, live that experience, and if you had a previous experience of this before.
Well, I have to compliment you again because we're speaking here in January of 24. Mm-hmm. The book came out in October mm-hmm. of 23. I've done most of the interviews I'm going to do for the book. You know, I was on a little press tour, but this is another question no one's asked me before. I have attended some menu meetings. It's been very limited. The two that I can think of offhand were actually in connection with the first book of my own that I ever wrote, a book called Knives at Dawn, which was about the Bocuse d'Or competition. And the year that I wrote that book, the guy who was going to compete for the United States was a chef named Timothy Hollingsworth. He now has a restaurant called Otium in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. At the time, he was a sous chef at the French Laundry, and he was training.
I had him on the podcast.
Oh, you've had Timmy on?
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
Oh, God, I loved him. But he
sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. But, you know, so I he was training in the town of Yountville, where the French Laundry is. Mm-hmm. And to really understand his whole orientation, I spent some time observing at the French Laundry. And every night there, after service, all the chefs pull stools around the central, the island, the kitchen island. Maybe it's, I don't know if it's what you call a piano. It doesn't matter. But yeah, but there's like a central kitchen island.
Yeah.
And they pull up their stools. And whatever open wine bottles there are get put out, you know. I don't know if they still do that now because it was a decade ago. And this meeting starts at like 1 a.m. or something. And
I mean, the one that you have in the book is at 12:30.
Yes. Yeah. So I mean, if it's after service, that's when it's going to be.
Yeah.
It felt less remarkable in Chicago than it did in Yountville. You don't hear cars going by in Yountville. And they would go, it was very similar. They went through at the French Laundry the produce that they had available. And then they would go through and then they would brainstorm the menu as a group. And that's how that happened. And then fascinating thing I got to observe was Tim, for that competition, had been working on what he was going to present in the competition. And it was a meat platter and a seafood platter. And it's too much for me to go into explaining. If people want to Google the Bocuse d'Or, it's a lot of inside baseball type stuff. But he presented it to Thomas Keller, right? And Thomas and Tim had a conversation after Tim finished cooking, and they were brainstorming ways to modify the two platters. And that was fascinating. Thomas is a smart guy. And it was amazing feedback. And the shorthand that they had between them, because Tim had worked for him for so long. I mean, that was really cool. So the French Laundry, three Michelin star restaurant, very expensive. The kind of restaurant that Johnny and Beverly very much, I don't want to say turn their back on, but if they've both decided that's not for them. You know, they don't like that kind of formal place. They don't want to charge customers as much. They don't like the pressure that comes with charging customers that much. So it's a different style of food. You know, Johnny likes to say that he wants it to feel like he has these great ingredients and you came over to his house and he made dinner for you, right? That was his way of looking at it. But yeah, so remarkably, actually, the French Laundry menu meeting and the Wherewithal menu meeting that's in the book, remarkably similar. Although the French Laundry, you know, there were, I don't know, eight people, nine people, and everybody was welcome to contribute ideas. And this menu meeting that I present in the menu ideation meeting that I present in the book, it's just, as you said, the chef owner and one of the chef owners and the chef de cuisine after service sitting there with the inventory sheets from the various farms, right? What's expected to come in the next week. And that's the starting point. And that was also the starting point at the French Laundry.
Or what's left, you know, as well in the
fridges.
Yeah,
or what's left. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But very similar process, very similar starting point, very similar, you know, letting it kind of grow from, no pun intended, from what's, you know, what's coming out of the earth,
sure.
You know.
Focus on the produce first, yeah.
Starting with the produce.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. For me, what is still interesting is reading, you know, that part of the book raised the question is, because it's still very unstructured, you know, the way how they approach like the creative aspect, when they decide this is the starting point, because back to the produce, then after that, the next step, the inspiration comes from everywhere. But today, with all the technology that exists, the way that you can, you know, gather information and so on, I would have expected that, you know, there's more, like say, structured in the way how to approach, like the brainstorming approach, you know, to the session. And so that was surprising. And then the other piece and the question I wanted to ask you is, do you think that AI is going to change that in the future?
Wow, these are great questions. I don't know as much about AI as I should and as I intend to. Everyone I know who knows a lot about this area and a lot about the industry, like for example, have you ever had Rich Rosendale on your show?
Mm-mm, no.
Yeah. Do you know who that is?
No, in fact.
He used to be a big culinary competitor. He was part of the Culinary Olympic team for the U.S. He competed for the U.S. at the Bocuse d'Or one year. And he has this complex down south. I haven't visited him down there. But, you know, all kinds of, you know, he's into state-of-the-art technology. He's owned restaurants. He teaches. And he's up on the AI thing. We were on a panel together in San Diego, late 2023. And, you know, he was saying, look, to the audience, it was all industry people. You may not like it, you may not understand it, but it's going to change everything. And I don't see how it can't. Certainly, as I understand it, you can teach AI models to, like, you take a book like Dornenberg and Page did that book, Culinary Artistry. Was that the one? No.
I'm thinking even the Flavor Bible, for
the instance. Flavor Bible, that's the one, right? Uh-huh. Okay. Well, you could just upload all that information and it would be, you know.
It'd probably be there already.
Scallops with parsnip puree and a red wine, you know.
Well, like, it goes together.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't know that AI could ever have, you know, these flights of fancy that truly, you know, brilliant chefs, but these are few and far between. Like I mentioned Jean-Louis Paladin, or you look at somebody like Pierre Gagné.
Sure.
You know, these people who just really, he hasn't
Michel
had a restaurant in a while, but Paul Liebrandt, who did you say?
Michel Bras.
Right. Yeah. Like
Sean Bach, you know,
is AI going to be able to be that Maybe like I know AI.
Maybe not in a creative process, but it's going to be useful to them in all the administrative tasks.
Oh, that for sure. But I don't know that it couldn't say, I don't know that you couldn't plug all of what's available, like on, like it, take the menu meeting that's in the book, right? Yeah. I don't know that you couldn't plug in all the produce, all the proteins, what's in the dry goods, you know, what's left over.
Yeah. Sure.
And
you can do that today.
And okay, we have a 7-course menu. I don't want to repeat any major ingredients. Press a button and it gives you a draft. You can change it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it saves you that initial...
It gives a skeleton, I would say, that you can, you know, work.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, so yes, I think that's inevitable.
What do you hope the readers will take away from your book?
Well, first and foremost, and the reason I wrote it was that I it sounds like such a basic thing. I just want them to have a greater appreciation for the people behind the meals they enjoy. You know, the example I give all the time talking about the book, and I've done it I think twice in the last week. You know, if I go to a restaurant that has an open kitchen, when I'm on the way out, I always thank the team. I always thank the staff, whether or not they know me or know that I'm a food writer. These people just cooked your dinner. You know, like, I think that's so weird that people don't. And sometimes there's people who sit at the counter, you know, and the people are closer than you and I are right now, you know, to the people cooking. And then they just get up and leave, you know? And I'm like, how do you do that without saying thank you? Or not even, okay, you paid for it. Maybe you don't feel you have to say thank you. Dinner was great. You know, thanks guys. Dinner was great.
Sure.
Whatever. I don't understand. I think that's bizarre on a human level.
You.
So I wanted that to happen indirectly because I don't get preachy about it in the book. I want people to understand why restaurant meals cost what they do. I mean, the 7-course tasting menu in this book cost at the time $85, not including tax and gratuity. But when you see just what went into raising and butchering the meat, what went into making the wine that the wine reduction comes from, what went into growing the herbs, what went into nurturing the tomatoes, which, you know, the tomatoes that are served in the book, which is the last week of July is when the book takes place, began as little seeds in little pods in, I think it was April. Right? Mm-hmm. And they were harvested in July. Okay. So they had to nurture them all that time, you know, protect them from the elements and keep an eye on them and, you know, adjust how much they're watered and all this stuff. And then each farm has to send a delivery driver from wherever they are. They're not in Chicago, right? Some of them are 2 hours away, some of them are 3 hours away.
So you want to say that $85 doesn't represent the real cost of what that meal should be.
Should be. And then again, it really struck me. I kind of always knew it, but to see it, you know, en masse, it's hard, you know, the financials are hard for the farmers also. Like should all be paying more.
So is it sustainable? Because I don't think the customer is ready to spend the real costs, you know, of what the meal should be.
Yeah. Well, this is another huge conversation. I've always believed for the prices to go up the way they should, and I believe the way they're going to have to at some point, unless we all just want to eat burgers and pizza all the time, I've always believed it was going to take a critical mass of restaurateurs in a given, whatever you want to call, market, city, region, to have like a press conference and do a big announcement and explain it and have chefs available to give interviews, you know, big name chefs to give interviews and explain why this is happening. But, you know, every chef I've ever spoken to about this subject, they have a huge fear of customers having sticker shock, you know, that customers are going to see prices and go and not come back.
I mean, we just saw that at the time of the pandemic or just after the pandemic, where they had to raise, you know, the prices to survive.
Yeah.
They were not able sometime to really, you know, inject like what should have been like the real price, you know, into like the new menu they were putting in place. But still, the price increased and the customers were kind of shocked and they were like, why? So, you know, we are still in that situation today that we are not spending or paying like the right prices, you know, for like the food that we're eating at most of those restaurants.
I agree. And I don't mean this critically because I understand the reasons for it, but I think the industry has kind of created a monster for itself because now the price adjustment that needs to happen, it hasn't happened incrementally. So now it seems massive, right? If it had happened incrementally, if it had tracked the rate of inflation, which it very much has not, right? It's lagging about 30% behind.
Cost of the raw materials. Yeah. Ingredients.
But if menu pricing had gone up the way the prices of other goods and services had gone up, it would have been a gradual thing. And I think it would have been an easier pill for, you know, the masses to swallow. It is going to be like ripping the Band-Aid off, but that moment's going to come. And some people have managed, you know, when Dirt Candy reopened in earnest here in New York after the pandemic, I can't remember if it was 30% or $30, but it's explained. I think it's still on their website, but it's explained, you know, this is what needed to happen. You know, my friend David Neufeld in San Francisco at KFICO, he and his business partner had a massive, they spent a lot of time during COVID playing war games with their budget and they increased prices and, you know, they're taking better care of their staff and, you know, it's all, they've pulled it off. I just ate there in July or August when I was out west and it was packed, you know, he pulled it off so far, but you know, yeah, but those are the reasons. Those are the reasons I wrote the book.
We can talk, you know, many hours.
Yeah, I'm sorry if
not at all. No, it's very interesting. But, you know, I'm looking at the time as well. And I want to make sure that I cover your podcast as well, Andrew Talks to Chefs. So if the people that are listening, I'm sure they know your podcast. If they don't, of course, please, you know, listen to Andrew Talks to Chefs. And yeah, so I'm curious, how do you choose the chefs, you know, that you interview?
So it's changed over time. Initially, it was just whoever I wanted to interview. It still sort of is that. But, you know, these days, because I've done close to 300 episodes now.
I'm not yet catching up on you. I just did 150.
That's pretty great. So if you interview enough chefs, there are a lot of similarities that are unavoidable. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always going to be a huge difference between someone who's gone the 3-star Michelin route and someone who has a small, independent, you know, inexpensive restaurant. But once you interview enough people at both ends of the spectrum and in between, there's a lot of similarities. So to be totally honest, I didn't used to do this, but now if I get pitched a guest or if I see someone who seems interesting, if I read something or see their Instagram, I will go and try to find other interviews, either video or audio, to see how entertaining they are. And I don't mean in a cheap way, but I mean, you know, my favorite interviews are the ones that mix the professional and creative evolution with real personal backstories. You know, when people share about, you know, their family or their childhood or their their relationships or whatever it is. And I really now, I feel like at this point, because I do hear a lot, more than I would have ever expected from young chefs and cooks who like, they'll say like, I just found your show and I'm listening to every episode from the beginning. I mean, that is mind blowing. It's so flattering.
Sure.
But I'm like, okay, how do I keep someone like that engaged now? And I feel like, okay, well, the chefy parts of a guest story might be the same, but you know, is someone willing to really go deep with me, or are they funny? You know, something that's going to make the interview still listenable. You know, it's like chefs who talk about, you know, to put it in chef terms, I want to change my menu periodically. I feel like I need to change the menu.
Yeah,
you know, but going into 2024, you know, I get pitched by PR firms so much. And to be honest, and I enjoy working with most of them, and I'm friends with some of them, but it makes it really easy to be lazy as yep. you are. I book my own show. I do yep. my own interviews. I do Same. My own prep. I edit. I mix. I put it out there. I promote it on social media.
Yep.
I do everything.
Likewise.
yeah, I know. So it's very easy to be more reactive than proactive. Going into this year, I have resolved that I'm going to try to be much more proactive. And we're sitting here on January 2nd, but I'm working up a list of, okay, who are people I really respect? Or who are some huge names that people would love to hear from that I haven't had on? And let me go get those people.
Yeah.
And I
can't. The same. I just, in fact, sent a bunch of email this morning.
Oh, did you?
On my list. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there are people I know. There are some people I know that are huge names. And I mean, sometimes when people are huge names, like I know they'll do it, but I kind of, like as their friend, I don't want to be the one more interview.
And it depends what you want to have out of the conversation, as we said before, because they are not the one that is like more on the creative process for the restaurant. But yeah. you can really talk about like leadership and, you know, management skills and, you know,
yeah. with business
with those people yeah. for sure. We are just, you know, starting 2024. So if you're looking back on 2023, and I know it's a tough question because if someone asks me that question, I'm sure I will answer it. But have you had like one of like a most memorable guests in 2023 that you were really excited to,
yeah.
to talk to?
So, I mean, in 2023 specifically, Jason Hamill, who's had Lula Cafe in yeah. Chicago mm-hmm. forever, we had an amazing interview.
Great.
I mean, you know,
the food is outstanding.
Well, the food's outstanding. It's a restaurant that survived longer than almost most restaurants do. He's, you know, he comes from an Italian-American family, which you would not get at all from his name or his, you know, he wanted to be a writer once upon a time and studied under the late David Foster Wallace.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Who's like, to me, like a God-tier writer. Yeah. So that was a great interview. Great interview. Oh, I had Eli Culp in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, yeah. Yeah.
You know, again.
And he has a podcast too, correct?
He does.
Yeah.
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 But, you know, Eli, as people may know, had a very successful young career in New York and Philly and then was in a terrible Amtrak accident.
Yeah.
And he's a quadriplegic mm-hmm, now. Mm-hmm. And he's really created a second act for himself. And that was a phenomenal interview. Rebecca Masson, who has a place called Fluff Bake Bar in Houston, but used to be in New York. She was the pastry chef at the Red Cat. She worked under Daniel Boulud at one time. She trained in France. She's very funny. We've known each other 20 years. I hadn't seen her since COVID. We were at the Hot Luck Festival in Austin back Memorial Day weekend. And that was an amazing interview. Telly Justice at Hags was phenomenal. Phenomenal. So, and everyone else who has been on the show, if I haven't named you, I'm just, you know.
Oh, I know. I know it's a tough question.
I'm just naming people who I felt.
Yeah, for what?
I mean, you know. Mostly what I'm talking about are people who just really bared it all. You know, just really, again, it was what I was talking about before. You know, interviews that really combine the culinary with something
story.
Else, something deeply personal.
We're going to switch to the rapid fire questions, but let's stay on the writing process. So do you have a process of writing? And we hear like so much, you know, from different writers that they write every day, you know, some people, you know, are early bird, they write every day in the morning. Some others, they are night owl and they write in the night. That's not my process, but I'm just curious to hear what was yours.
Well, I certainly don't have that kind of regularity. It's embarrassing for me to say this. I'm still playing with different models of how I schedule my time. I don't like structure that way. It sounds like artsy fartsy to me, but you know, sometimes you feel it and sometimes you don't. You know, what I try to do, and I do meditate now. I have my own meditation that I've written out, and it's just like a checklist of things that I don't do well naturally. And so every day, as when I do that in the morning, I am thinking about how the day before went, what kind of things are working. You know, so I try to identify patterns that work for me, like taking breaks. I need breaks. I don't like the feeling of burnout at the end of a day. I don't like the feeling of being depleted. You know, in terms of the actual writing itself, sometime in the last couple of years, it occurred to me that everything I do is a vehicle for my interviews. You know, I feel like I'm a pretty good writer, and that's not false modesty. I feel like I don't even have to go to the David Foster Wallaces of the world. I have friends who are better writers than I am. And they're not like great novelists. They're, you know, people who are writing about restaurants and food. But I think I'm a good writer. But I think I'm, again, not to be arrogant, I think what I do really well is interview. I feel like that is my skill. And I love it. And I've, you know, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, my last book, I had done about 220 interviews for that book. I had to supplement it with a lot of research. This book was all based, I observed and I interviewed. That there was no research, really. I tend to look for things that, you know, I'm not looking for a scholarly book where I'm going to, you know, spend a lot of time alone reading other books or going to the library or, no, I want books. My next book is like this as well. I like to get on a plane, go somewhere, put some protein bars in my bag, have a Moleskine notebook and a Uniball pen and a pocket digital recorder and go, you know, and that's like the Indiana Jones phase of my life. And then I come home and I get it transcribed and, you know, and then I figure out how to put it together. And to me, the writing is just, this is how I think about it in my head. I think about it like I'm laying down, I don't know, a bunch of stones or something, like almost for a pathway. And then the writing is like the cement, you know, like that I'm pouring and it's going to hold everything together, right? But it's all starts with the quotes. And my first drafts often, like certainly if there's a profile of someone in the book, as this book is made up of those profiles, you know, I take the interview and I pare it down and I move quotes around. And then I fill in with writing, with prose. I mean, that's what I do. And it was funny when you said earlier about the menu meeting that it surprised you how they kind of meander. You know, they don't just go, you know, they don't go amuse, appetizer. Sure. You know, like the first thing they come up with was the intermezzo, mm-hmm. pre-dessert, yep. right? That's the first thing.
With the tomato.
Just because yep. someone had that idea. But that's how I write. Like, and I can't explain why, but I don't worry about it. If there's a part of a book I'm working on, like I have a friend who's a painter, right? And they'll be painting in a corner of the thing, and then they're over here, and you know, like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. Mm-hmm. Wherever I'm feeling it on a given day, so, yeah, that's yeah. where I go, and yeah. I don't worry. But if I'm generating pages, I'll figure out how it fits together later.
Do you write in silence or with music?
I write with instrumental music. Okay. If there's lyrics, I find the words yeah. too distracting.
Too distracting. Thinking about food now, and you're based in New York. So if you and I were going on a tasting tour in New York, which 5 spots would you take me to?
Boy, I would take you to. So our last stop would be Superiority Burger.
Okay.
Which I just went to the new incarnation. For people who don't know, that's Brooks Heedley's vegetarian restaurant. Mm-hmm. Brooks used to be a very accomplished pastry chef, but you know, this place has, you know, veggie burgers and a really fun menu, and they have a late night menu. So I would end there.
Okay.
And then for kind of the main event, the meal that we would have, I think maybe we would go to a restaurant that's one of my favorites right now is Francie in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And then prior to Francie for a little bit of a snack, we would go to Una Pizza Napolitana, and we would just split one pizza at the bar.
Okay.
And prior to that, we would have cocktails at
Maison Premier.
Maybe Maison Premier. I do love Maison Premier.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay, I'll go with that. I was going to say Leyenda, but we would go to Maison Premier. And then just to kind of start things off with a few little snacks and maybe a little champagne or cava, we would go to Tia Paul, tapas restaurant in Chelsea.
Very good.
That's my reverse order.
Okay, so we have to put that in a calendar now. What's your go-to guilty pleasure food?
Oh, well, this is what it would be. It would be a Big Mac, fries, and a vanilla shake from McDonald's.
Oh, wow.
And I actually love that so much that I never eat it in New York. I only, like, I have friends who only smoke when they're in Europe. I'm serious. I do. Just two.
I like the comparison.
But that's the rule, right? Yeah, they don't smoke here, but if they're in France, they're allowed to smoke. I it's just a slippery slope. I don't eat McDonald's
in New York.
In New York. And there's only one thing I get from McDonald's. I have no interest in anything else on the menu. My whole life, I have loved a Big Mac. And I mean, McDonald's fries, but I
the fries,
get that's, a little respect.
That's my favorite.
They get respect.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But I do. I love a Big Mac. I think it's a masterpiece.
So last question, any recent cookbooks that you have that caught your eyes and or inspired you?
Yeah, a couple. One was the Lulu Cafe cookbook, which is why Jason Hamill was on my show. One, Sofra, the Iranian restaurant in Brooklyn, which I had not eaten. I have since eaten there and it's great.
I've seen the book, yeah.
But Nassim, the chef and owner, did this book, which I think is terrific. And there was what does he call it? The Middle Eastern Pantry?
Mm-hmm.
Lior Lev Sarkaz, who has...
The spice.
Yeah, who has Le Boite, which is a spice, a very successful spice company. He's
in New York.
I don't know if people know. The first time I met him, he was in the kitchen at Danielle. I mean, he's a former professional cook.
Okay.
But I thought that was a really cool book. I thought that was a really, really cool book. And I'm sure there's others I'm not mentioning, but those are the three that immediately come to mind that I really enjoyed. Oh, I'm sorry. There is one more. I'm not a baker, but Nancy Silverton has a new dessert book out. It's called The Cookie That's
I don't remember.
Saved My Life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so irresistible. It's around 100 recipes. She took 100 classic desserts and this was like her COVID project and developed what for her are the ultimate versions of all of them, right? And so like, for example, there's a carrot cake and she said, you know, carrot cake never really tastes like carrot. So she came up with this idea and she did a similar thing with the cornbread in the book is she roasted some carrots and then incorporated that into the into the batter, I guess, and then baked it, right? So because she roasted a portion of it, it intensified the carrot flavor, so it actually tastes like carrot. But that's like what she came up with, she applied different little tricks to all these desserts in the book, and I love that kind. It's such a perfect thing for her to have done. And I got to add one more. It may not be 2023. It might have been 2022. And I can't even remember the name offhand, but Jacques Pepin.
Oh, yeah, sure.
The chicken book.
Yes.
What's it called? I can't remember the name.
I don't know, but he has published a new one too now.
But his book, he did a book. It's basically, I mean, he wrote a biography, which was The Apprentice, but he, you know, Jacques paints and he did a book. It's his paintings of chickens and recipes involving chickens. Yeah. And then there's essays about chickens, but they each kind of apply to a time in his. It's kind of like a biography through chicken recipes.
Yes,
and there's only one person in the world who could have written that book.
And so I had him on the podcast, and we talked about this, and he was telling me that in fact for this book he had to fight against like the publisher because they wanted him to put recipes. Originally, he didn't want to have any recipe in the book on the chicken. But he had to, you know, concede, you know, a little bit and be flexible and add, you know, some recipe. But the focus was more about all the rest and the stories, you know.
Oh my around, God! Around such chicken. A charming book.
Yes,
and such a reflection.
And such a nice man.
I was just going to say, such a reflection. I mean, you know, as you know, and I know, and everyone who's around the industry knows, there are people who seem really great on television or. What sure. on their social media or if they're in their dining rooms and but privately, not so great. Jacques Pepin, I told him once, I said, he's like the gentleman chef.
He is. Andrew, thank you very much. Thank you for your time and sharing all those thoughts. And for people listening, make sure to buy the book, The Dish, you know, from Andrew Feedman and listen to his podcast, Andrew Talks to Chef.
Thank you. And my turn to have you back now.
Thank you for listening today to the Flavors Unknown podcast, and a special thank you to Andrew Feedman for guiding us through the fascinating narratives of his new book, The Dish, and sharing the behind the scenes from Andrew Talks to Chefs podcast. Today's conversation not only offered a deeper understanding of the culinary industry's collaborative nature, but also reminded us of the importance of questioning assumptions and embracing the unknown in the kitchen. Keep exploring the unknown flavors and stories that the culinary world has to offer. Until next time, keep your palate curious and your questions ready.
And until then, keep in mind that the people who likes to eat are always the best people.
Thanks for listening to Flavors Unknown. If you've enjoyed this episode, give us a follow on Instagram at Flavors Unknown and visit us at flavorsunknown.com. Don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts.